Welcome to Season 4 of The Farcast, bringing you experts and insiders every week to help you navigate the economic and investing landscape. And now, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to The Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week, April the 29th. Here we are, the end of the first month of the second quarter, for those of you keeping track, and I am keeping track. We still have tax day in front of us. Don't forget, we had two amazing speeches yesterday with a lot of amazing earnings. Whole lot to talk about this week on the Farcast as we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world. President Biden had a terrific speech last night, according to many. They said that it was a mild-mannered middle-class manifesto. That's what it sounded like to me as well, a mild-mannered middle-class manifesto. You got a very mild-mannered speech from Jay Powell yesterday as well, also pledging to keep rates low, and we know we're going to have inflation and a little surge, but don't worry about it. Futures didn't soar on any of this, which was kind of shocking to me from both of these things. I mean, futures are up a little bit. And we had great earnings from the tech sector, from Google, from Apple. I thought the earnings were good for Microsoft as well, but Wall Street didn't like them as much. We had great earnings. People been worried about the big tech pullback, a collapse of tech. This isn't going to work anymore. Oh, woe is me. We've been climbing this wall of worry that I've been talking about. And I said, I don't see the market getting ready to go down. I don't see the big correction. I disagree with B of A and these other places. So far, I'm right, which doesn't mean anything, except that it is so far I'm right. We'll find out if Kenny Polcari is right, because he's joining us right now from Case Capital Advisors. Kenny, you're also hosting. What's your new gig you're going to be hosting?
The Weiss Investor Podcast, which is going to be posting its first podcast probably next week.
Investor Podcast.
Weiss Ratings is a financial, research firm down here in Palm Beach, been around for 50 plus years. And, they rate everything from banks to insurance companies and in stocks and ETFs and mutual funds. They really have quite a deep database, and they're launching a podcast. And so therefore I have the pleasure of being the host on that podcast. And so,
I don't know. I don't envy you, Kenny. You're going to have to go out there and compete with the Farcast. I mean, how the hell do you compete with the Farcast,
Kenny? Mikey, tough. It's two different things, you and me, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, anything really that gets more information out to investors, right. Really, if we can get more information out to investors and if we can bring our experience to bear. You know, one thing, Kenny, that strikes me every time I meet a new wealthy client. I meet these folks who have just sold their businesses for anywhere from $20 million to $1 billion. I sit down and talk with them, and somehow they're sure that they're going to have a unique approach to investing that they've figured out that nobody else has figured out, and they're going to get this really right because they figured out something intellectually better than you, Ken, and that I have after all of our years of doing this.
Right.
Isn't that amazing? Do you find that?
I do. But, you know, actually, yes, I do with some. But most of the people that I'm talking to are people that recognize that they need the help, right? That they're tired of trying to do it on their own. They've got too many other things going on, and they come to somebody who they has got credibility, that they trust, that's got a history, that's got some insight to really help them. So, you know, that's where I find kind of my sweet spot. My demographic are people that actually that recognize they want the guidance and the partnership.
You know, I have a sister who is a lawyer, but she plays a doctor in real life. With the help of the internet, she seems to diagnose absolutely everything about everybody with a great amount of certainty, by the way.
Right.
And, this business, it's one of those things where, you know, as doctors, everybody's got a body and everybody's got an elbow and a knee, and they can all sort of talk from personal experience about how the damn things work.
Right.
And yet we still go to doctors. Folks, 35 years of doing this, and Kenny's almost 40 years of doing this because he's older than I am. You know, it matters. It really matters. You're not long-term going to compete with us. You're just not. And I used to feel so cocky when I would say that. And now, after all the experience and watching and having learned all that I've had to learn the hard way, it doesn't work that way. Okay, Kenny, enough of this. Tell me what you think about markets and the speeches and what's going on now. Has anything changed in your opinion since last week?
Yes, because I was concerned that that Powell was in fact going to change the terminology a little bit, change the language, something that might indicate that there's a change of thinking going on.
A little taper, maybe.
Anything taper, paper, anything that sounds like taper, right? I thought that was a real.
You just have to sound like it. That'll spook markets.
I just thought that maybe that was going to happen, which, by the way, would have been which would have been way off base considering what they've told us for months and months and months. But yet, this talk about inflation, you see it, I see it, we're living with it, I see it everywhere we go. You have to turn on the news and prices are going up. And so for the Fed to say it's not a problem, it's not a problem, kind of makes me a little bit nervous. And so I actually kind of thought we were going to hear maybe a change in terminology yesterday. And quite honestly, what I saw was not only was there not a change in terminology, he actually got, and I guess I can't blame him at some point. Did you watch him when he started to get visibly annoyed? Because they kept pressing him on inflation and are they behind the eight ball? And he made it very clear that he's not worried about inflation. They got plenty of tools in the toolbox. He thinks it's going to be temporary. He keeps saying that, and that he's remaining accommodative. And it's not even worth talking about the word tapering. Never mind doing it because we're way too far away. And at some point, when they get to that point, that the Fed is going to announce it and put it out there well in advance of before they even start tapering so that the world and investors and everyone can start to get much more comfortable with it. But for right now, unless he's pulling the wool over everyone's eyes, he's not going anywhere, not doing anything, certainly at this meeting, but nor does it sound like it's going to be the June meeting or quite honestly, even the August meeting.
Okay, but look, I think that message, even though, okay, so what do we have him doing? We have him stomping his foot while he repeats the same damn message.
Right.
Right. I'm stomping my foot. I'm going to have a little minor tantrum here and make sure that you all understand that I mean this exactly. But Kenny, that doesn't ease my nervousness over this process, this continued, you know, stimulus, liquidity, ease, accommodation as the economy takes off with this. He almost sounds cockier that he's going to be able to script this thing right.
Agreed. So I 1,000% I agree with you because, you know, I've been nervous about these underlying pressures all along. I keep saying it. But every time I say it, the market marches higher and he comes out and he says, we're not worried. And look what's happening today, which I'm actually surprised that yesterday afternoon when he got done stamping his feet that the market didn't turn yesterday. The fact that it ended kind of a little bit weaker, not substantially. The S&P was only up 3 points. But I was actually surprised. But look what's happening this morning. Now, again, we got Apple and Facebook overnight, blew the roof off the house. Tonight is going to be Amazon. There's going to be 11. There's going to be 50 plus companies today. Caterpillar, Merck, all these big, but Comcast, Western Digital, Steel, all going to report today. And if it stays like it is, 80 or 84% of them are going to beat on the bottom and top lines. And so futures are up. We're going to slice right through 4,200 on the S&P like a hot knife through butter. Thank you, Barbara Streisand. And then we're going to go higher because he's made it very clear that the Fed is going to continue to hold your hand and feed you the Valium and lie down on the couch and let's talk about this, but we're not going anywhere. And so,
you know,
it
I just
is
love it when you say
trick.
Butter. I do.
Butter.
I love it when you say
butter. Yeah, well,
that's butter.
The New that's the Brooklyn, New York butter, hot knife through butter.
So, okay, but Kenny, just for historical purposes, how many quarters in a row basically has the S&P beaten 80% of the companies beaten on the top and bottom line? Isn't it always 80%?
No, it's usually in the 70s, right? It's like 72 to 75%. This one has been much more significant only because of the comparison over last year, right? Where we were last year in a complete middle of a crisis. And so this one is actually above.
Well, wait a minute. That says that they were beating analyst estimates. The analysts didn't know we were going to beat where we got a combo over last year. I mean, come on.
You and I could talk about this all day. As a matter of fact, get rid of all the other guests. Let's just continue this.
We'll just keep going.
Here's the problem with the analysts. Now, it's either the analysts being very conservative, or it's the companies who weren't offering enough guidance to the analysts for them to make a proper evaluation. Because look, when you see earnings that are beating by 50 and 60 and 70%, you really got to scratch your head and say, okay, what the hell's going on here? What are these guys doing, right? They're not either not paying attention, or they were specifically led to these numbers. So when they report, they blow the roof off the house, which is what they've done.
If your local weatherman, even a weatherman who's always wrong, if they were off by 60 or 70%, you'd fire them.
Of course you would. You wouldn't even look at them anymore, right? But now what happens is this is what's happening. We're going to see it. We saw it last night in Apple and Facebook again. You're probably going to see it in Amazon. I got to believe Amazon is going to be every metric you can imagine. Huge. And then some.
Right, I agree.
She's only going to send Kenneth, Bernie.
Let's get this down for Fred and Ethel, because they're seeing companies that are beating estimates. And to them, they're going to tell you, we're seeing fundamentals improve. We're seeing earnings support these prices. Last week, Surat Sethi told me that he thought that stocks were fairly valued. I said, I would say fully valued.
I would agree with you. But listen, rates are at zero. They're going to stay at zero. So therefore, it's that Tina trade, right? There's no alternative. And so therefore, as long as rates stay at zero, valuations can continue to expand. Now, if that starts to change, and look, the 10-year is ticking at 1.65 today. I think we're going to see the 10-year kind of heat up a little bit. And that's going to, I keep saying it, that's going to put a cap on the market and at least cause it to stop going up and maybe churn to allow the economy to catch up. But one way or the other, I agree with you. I think this adjustment or correction in prices is coming. I actually thought it was going to be, this week after yesterday's appearance by the Fed, but apparently it isn't, at least not right now.
Get better, though, I get more nervous. I really do. As these conditions keep getting better, I keep getting more nervous. Let me go to one question, and we're out of time. I can't believe it. But one question here, Kenny. I'm seeing something that doesn't quite make sense. I'm seeing the dollar fall. So on all of this Fed news yesterday, we're seeing the dollar fall.
Right.
It's getting crushed by the euro. Also seeing the 10-year treasury fall now, which means the yield's going higher, up around 165.
Right.
Usually when the treasury yield goes higher, ladies and gentlemen, foreigners buy, foreign companies and others buy U.S. bonds, which means they have to buy dollars to do that. And you see the dollar strengthen. But right now we've got the bond getting weaker, 10-year note getting weaker, and we got the dollar getting weaker. And what does that mean to you, Kenny? And also, I want to watch those multinationals if that trend toward a weaker dollar continues.
Right. Well, so there's a disconnect. I would agree with you. There's the disconnect between what the dollar is telling you and what bonds are telling you. I think that's a short-term disconnect, because I do think if Jay Powell's right, they're going to control yields. And so yields should start coming back down and bonds should stabilize and at least stabilize, if not start to move up again, right? Because we saw yields up here at 1.7 and then for 3 or 4 weeks they were trading they came back to 1.5. This little spurt yesterday or the last week up to 1.6, I think is going to I think it's short term. And I think the Fed made it very clear. Now the dollar is getting weaker because the Fed's not going anywhere, right? They're not raising rates. So the dollar got weaker. That makes sense. But look, as the dollar gets weaker, commodities are going to be supported because commodities are priced in dollars, that inverse relationship. But to your point, the multinationals are also going to benefit with a weaker dollar because they make these sales overseas. They bring the money back to the United States. They convert it into dollars. Get more dollars. It flows right to their bottom line.
It sounds like, it's tough to get anybody excited about the dollar. I can get them excited about the dollar, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, who gets excited about the dollar? Kenny Pokorry is the answer from Case Capital Advisors and one of our longest contributors here in our fourth season of the Farcast, believe it or not. Kenny, thanks. We hope you'll come back soon.
I'm Michael. I'll be back next week. Just call me.
That's wonderful. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be back with Dan Mahaffey. We're going to pore over the president's speech last night, the mild-mannered middle-class manifesto, and then the real Yoda of the Farcast, Jack Barugian, will be with us for segment 3. I can't wait to hear what he has to say. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Michael Farr and the Farcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Heroes' work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Heroes' mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farcast and your host, Michael Farr. Welcome back to the Farcast, and now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Joining us now, our great friend Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, and our senior political analyst on the Farcast. Welcome back, Dan.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for having me.
We're glad you're here. Jay Powell yesterday giving a speech, the President of the United States addressing a joint session of Congress in what looked like a State of the Nation, but it wasn't because we don't call it that because of some sort of technicality that I've never understood. And we also heard the Republican response, which was a little bit strange. It was called a mild-mannered middle-class manifesto from the president last night, which actually, as I listened to it, I thought it was pretty much right on. Right. What did you think?
Look, I think it was one classic Joe Biden. If you want to think of a mid-20th century liberal, I'm not talking culture war progressive, but if you're going back to kind of the LBJ, FDR era of liberalism and what Joe Biden, you know, a creature of the Congress there, back in his element, that was what that speech struck me as, and something where you see a massive agenda. Look, they're moving ahead with it. They're not being shy about their goals. And they're riding the popularity of these proposals where things like minimum wage, things like the tax increases for corporations. I think it was very effective when he said, look, we're not focusing on the middle class. Look, we're not even focusing on those of you who make $350,000 a year. I'm talking about the 650 guys who made $1 trillion during a pandemic. You know, that's a very effective message and blunts a lot of the, oh my God, Chavez style socialism is coming down the pike narrative, as well as highlighting to the administration's, I think, accomplishments. And it's something that has gone back through. They did it very effectively on the campaign trail through the election. And now as an administration, they manage expectations to a T.
Okay, so this is an old-fashioned politician, an old-fashioned Democrat. Dan, he hasn't been sounding as sort of middle of the road moderate as he sort of suggested he was going to when he took office. I mean, he does feel like he has moved a little bit further left in his message, though I've got to say that given the new census, given the split in the Senate, given the close call in the House, and that, you know, there does really seem to be something of a division on Capitol Hill, a lot of his agenda, it feels like, has lost some of their teeth. So while he says he may be doing things that strike folks as a little more left-leaning, can he get them done? It doesn't sound like a lot of this stuff is going to get done.
No, look, I think it, on capital gains, we talked about it in the last episode. I don't think they get their full rate there. You've had senators, you know, we talked about Manchin, but Menendez from New Jersey, Warner from Virginia are talking about there still needs to be some kind of difference between capital to promote investment, that you don't want to go all the way in that proposed capital gains tax hike. So these things are going to get diluted, but they still have the ability to move through on reconciliation. They're holding that card in their back pocket. And I think he says, look, I'm going to put out my bold plan. It's going to be very FDR. But at the end of the day, even if he doesn't get the whole FDR, he might get an LBJ or perhaps an Obama and a half. And that, you know, that's a pretty darn good accomplishment with a 50-50 Senate and riding this momentum too. You know, I think the narrative that is the longer column to be written, and I think Bloomberg, I saw someone, I think on Bloomberg start to pick this up, is how the Biden-Powell era will be something like the Reagan-Volcker era was in reshaping the economy. And that the Reaganomics era pendulum in America is shifting. And Biden sees that in his poll numbers. He sees that generationally, and they see that as momentum for these programs.
Jay Powell better get this right. Jay Powell is putting a lot of his chips out there on the line, and the Fed is doing something new. And we started to hear about this from Jeff Lacker, former president of the Richmond Federal Reserve Bank. And that was, and you're seeing it now, folks, you're seeing it. So watch this. This is important. There is a shift on the Fed to having a social concern about the unemployed, the homeless, that part of the bottom half of the very bottom quarter, bottom fifth of the economy, the poor in this country, and what the Fed is doing to create jobs for them. That's never been part of the Fed's mandate. And it doesn't matter, ladies and gentlemen, listen to me, it doesn't matter that it is laudably social goal. It doesn't matter that you like it and that you think this is a good thing for the Fed to do. The Fed has a dual mandate. They're there to do, basically, it was only one job, and it was price stability. That's where the Fed started out. Price stability, keep the economy balanced. Then they took on a second mandate, which was employment, reasonably full employment. Now we're taking on a new social aspect and concern of what that employment looks like. I think that this is a very, very dangerous path economically. Somebody else has to handle employment for the poor, folks. I want to do it. I want to go and help. I want to be philanthropic. I care. I absolutely care about the poor and the disenfranchised and the homeless. And I put my money where my mouth is, but that's not where the Federal Reserve should put their money. And it's a great concern to me. What do you think, Dan? I feel like it's a little bit of political pandering going on here. Is the Fed under that much of the gun that they have to make a social swing to the left?
Well, I don't think it's so much of a social swing to the left. I think you're right in the analysis of the expansion of its mandate beyond what is legally there. You know, there are skeptics on the other side who will say, look, a central bank exists to do whatever the sovereign wants to stay afloat. So the mandate, though, of
the sovereign is the American people here, though. It's not Putin and it's not Xi Jinping, you know.
Correct.
So
the question becomes for the Fed, though, and the here's where the debate about this will be, and whether these things are starting to affect the Fed's mandate or approaches are there's the socially laudable goals, and then there's the impact of inequality on the economy, the impact of things like climate change, and they incorporate those into their simulations, their analyses, and that's starting to hit on some political third rails, but there are also issues that, look, we find our CEOs talking about inequality. We find the Fed talking about it on climate change. All these people who previously shouldn't have had to talk about this because our politicians are supposed to do their jobs,
yes,
and solve these problems, now find themselves having to talk about it because Congress is so deadlocked and useless. And
well,
perhaps
what I'm wondering is, you know, there's been such huge pressure on audit the Fed and that we've got to go track the Fed and we want control over the Fed. Congress wants to control monetary policy, which if you want to watch a disaster of just immeasurable proportions, right, let Congress get involved with the central bank. I mean, there is nothing that I think could go nuclear faster economically. But now, you know, I'm wondering, are they feeling pressure to go and kind of respond and be attentive this way? And is it just going to be lip service attention? Jay Powell is meeting with a group of homeless people coming up. That's in the right. news headlines this morning. Why? Why in the hell is the head of the Federal Reserve meeting with a group of homeless people?
Well, I think that's certainly performative. But, you know, look, I think all of us in positions of privilege, be it
wait, you think that's what performative?
I do think it's performative in
what
a sense.
What the hell does performative mean?
It's acting. It's kabuki theater. It's, oh, fine, you know, it's showing, you know, it's performative. At the same time,
I don't think I've ever known that word, performative. I like that.
Performative politics. So much is performative these days. But
got it.
At the same time, look, I think he sees it as a reminder. You know, he was Jesuit educated. We can't forget that.
Which we like about him a lot.
For those who have many, there's a requirement to give back much. And he sees that in his mandate, but that's not, we have priests for that. That's not national policy. But when the politics fail to do that, when our own society seems to fail to do that, these are the people who are now finding themselves in the position of having to step up. At the same time, we have to acknowledge this political environment, and it was framed very well in some comments with some people I spoke to, younger Americans, millennials, who will say, look, we've seen the taps opened for Wall Street twice in a generation. We've seen the taps opened for banks. We've seen the taps opened for corporations. You know, when is it finally time for the American people to get it? We've seen tax cuts go to buybacks. You know, these, again, you agree with it or disagree with it, this is the political message that is prevailing among middle class and lower class Americans right now.
But this is hijacking the facts. Okay. I mean, those taps were open, and did they benefit Wall Street and did they benefit rich Americans and all of that? Yes, they did. But they were opened at a moment of extremis. They were opened when the economy was on the verge of collapse and going into depression. And they were opened by the Federal Reserve to save the economy. And they did it by increasing all of these balance sheets of all of these places who had assets. And indeed, the economy did not crash. And indeed, the economy recovered. And I think perhaps, you know, at a certain point, the policy was not any longer necessary, but they kept continuing with it, right? I mean, they kept up with this stuff saying we need more opium. Well, we can get into the argument there, young Americans, and I'm not going to disagree with you, but let's go to the point. They did not do this just to make people rich. They did not do this to help corporations or their wealthy backers or anything like that. That did not happen. They did it to save the economy. It did create wealth disparity. It did put enough money out there that the economy didn't crash. And even during that period, the poorest of the poor had their lot in life elevated. They were a hell of a lot less poor than they would have been if the government hadn't done that, even though the rich got richer. So it saved the economy. And now what is the question? But boy, this dividing it up as a class war, it just further divides America. I think it's so I think it's insidious.
Well, and here's the challenging part, Michael. Look, you and I, we're having this conversation. We're looking at both sides of it. We're talking about the role of the Fed. Look, we've talked about the debt, the impact of that, putting this all on the national tab in the long run. This is the conversation that needs to be happening. And that's where the challenge for Senator Tim Scott in giving the Republican response last night is that we're not having, for the most part, a response on those facts. That's the thing that I found interesting for Biden is he's almost proposing these in a vacuum because he puts forward these big popular proposals. And what do you hear back? War on hamburgers, Dr. Seuss, transgender bills. Like the economic messages are lost when you have the these economic messages are being trampled by the culture war messages. And I feel for Senator Tim Scott being out there forced to talk about a police reform bill
right
when 50% of the Republican voters think Chauvin wasn't guilty.
Right. Right.
You know, it's how these culture war things are just trampling the economic message doesn't serve those of you who are listeners, who are conservative in their economic and financial viewpoints in this debate right now.
Well, it's just trying to make everything more political. Look, I mean, my points here, folks, are the Federal Reserve has a job and it shouldn't be politicized, number one. Number two, the actions taken during these horrible periods of 2008 and 2009, when the banking system was collapsing and really the economy could have gone into another serious Great Depression in this country with soup lines and everything else, that was avoided because of what proved to be, I think, effective policy that was very creative. We hadn't seen it before. Those are just facts. And now we want to put them in some sort of political bucket of the people I like or the people I don't like. It's not helpful. Where should we be as an economy? What should we be doing now that will be the right thing for the economy, and the right thing for the economy will be the right thing for all Americans? All right, Dan, we're out of time, but I need you to tell me, please, in the president's speech last night, we go into sales mode now, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he made his points and now he goes out. He's going to go to Georgia today and meet with President Carter, and they're going to be photo ops, and he's going to be selling more of his speech. Other Democrats are going to be selling more of his package. What really gets done, and when? We've got an election in November. I mean, the clock is ticking, 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 yeah, as Marissa Tomei said in my cousin.
Look, they want to get this done through the summer. I think they try and say, look, we're going to listen to these proposals, but they've got all the tools they need with that reconciliation to move ahead with 50 votes in the Senate.
Do they get Manchin? Do they get the others? Do they get Susan Collins?
They'll try. I think, look, if they can perhaps get Susan Collins or others, I doubt it, because look, if they can get that whole package through, it's what gets Manchin. And again, I said Menendez, Warner, Sinema, Kelly. There's still other Senate.
Yeah, Warner has said moderates. He's not in.
Yeah, so they're not in
and
for that full
tax policy. Huh?
Yeah, they're not in for that full tax hike, but you're going to get something, like I said, you know, smaller. He's put out his bold plan. He's still going to play up what they got down the road. I think by the end of the summer, you see this start to come through. But, you know, maybe not the whole thing, but I guess I'd say they'll probably get 75 to 80% of this.
Dan, he took on China in a very real and serious way last night. That gave me great confidence. I was very glad to hear it. Let's talk about that next week, can we?
Yeah, we need to talk about that next week. We need to talk about India next week, too.
India's big right now. Yeah, and God bless those folks in India who are suffering. So they are in our thoughts and prayers. Ladies and gentlemen, Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress and the senior political analyst on The Farcast. When we come back, Yoda himself, Jack Barugian. I can't wait. Please stay with us.
Thank you for joining us on The Farcast. And now, back to your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Joining me now is Yoda, ladies and gentlemen, for The Farcast. He is our Yoda. He is our sage guide. He is our visionary and seer. When you climb the mountain, waiting at the top with his view of life is Jack Barugian, who is the chief economist and founder of UCX Group. You've seen him on television. He's been a great friend of mine for many, many years. And you've listened to The Farcast. When you want to find out who's got it right, we go to Jack Barugian. Hey, Jack, welcome back to The Farcast.
Thanks, Michael. That was quite an introduction. I appreciate that.
Yeah, listen, Yoda-esque is where we're going with you. Yoda, and given your new hairstyle there, Jack, I'm thinking, you know, I'm liking it. I'm liking it. You're way taller, however. All right, Jack, we had amazing speeches yesterday by Jay Powell. We had an amazing speech by the president last night. It's been called the mild-mannered middle-class manifesto from the president last night, which I liked a lot. Tell us what you think. We had great tech earnings. What's going on with Jay Powell, who seemed to be getting more irritated when they kept asking him about taper and when are you going to change? And he says, we're not even going to discuss it. big bets that the chairman is making here on this economy and continuing this accommodation. What do you think, Jack?
Well, I think, Michael, we're seeing something that none of us have seen in our lifetime. You know, we're seeing this combination of easy money and incredible stimulus coming out of the government. Look, they're talking about spending $4 trillion, all right, if this all goes through. That is a quarter of our GDP. That's an insane number. And so I guess the real question is this: how much will that spending really be once it's all finished and done?
Right.
Because we've already done a lot. And when will Jay Powell start to tap on the brakes? Because that is the question that we're all asking. Until then, it's the David Tepper trade. You just buy everything and you just let everything go up until you get a signal from the Fed that they're going to do something, if anything. All right. And tapping on the brakes, I wish they would have said something yesterday just to let us know, instead of having to slam on the brakes if we see another set of inflation data that comes out that starts to really spark a fear. Because if that happens, which I don't think it will, but if that happens, you're going to really have hundreds of millions of people lose purchasing power parity. It won't be the people like us or the people listening to the show or the people whose money you're managing, but it'll be the mom and pop out there who's sitting on a lot of cash, or, you know, who's done everything right their entire lives, and they've saved every dollar they've ever made. And all of a sudden, the money that they've gone out and saved is worth nothing. It's been completely debased.
But Jay Powell did the opposite yesterday, Jack. I mean, during his Q&A, not only did he not, he basically said, we're not going to talk breaks. We're not going to discuss breaks. We're not going to discussing tapping on the brakes. He doubled down or tripled down yesterday. And, you know, I had Surat Sethi on last week, and he said, I think stocks are fairly valued. I said, Surat, I think they're fully valued. And then you see these earnings come along. So the fundamentals actually look like they're supporting some of these higher prices. So I guess what I'm hearing you say is the Fed is keeping the band playing, the punch bowl is full, and it doesn't stop until it stops?
Let me put it a different way. You don't get a hangover when you're drinking. You get a hangover when you're done drinking. All right. Right now, everybody's drinking. Right? We're all drinking and enjoying this party. And, you know, the Fed has got the window, and you buy, you know, anything from a Bitcoin, and, you know, which I own, as I've told you back for months now. Everything's going up, you know, and it can't last. So I guess the real question is, when Jay Powell says he's not going to do anything, what's really behind that motivation? And I think it's really a question of where he sees inflation, and is it really transitory? All right. And see, that is, I guess, the real question that we all have to ask ourselves, especially going into these next couple of years.
Jack, you know, he says that it's transitory. Now, I was talking with Paul Kari about this earlier this morning. I've watched Fed chairs, I've watched economists over the years tell me what the economy was going to do with great certainty over the next 6 months. And every time I burst out laughing. I mean, I can't think of anything that's more unwieldy than the U.S. economy. And to give me a precise prediction in a 6 month period and say, I know this is going to happen, is just absurd.
Yeah.
I mean, and the peril is in being wrong when you're the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Why is he putting so many chips on the table right now?
I think, and this is really what it comes down to from a real basic level. Let's go back to the 1970s when you and I were just young kids. All right.
I remember it.
And inflation was out of control. And if you remember correctly, you know, one in every seven Americans worked in the auto industry.
Yes.
And automobiles went up every year, and everything went up. It was price. You had these unions that came in and had cost of living increases every year. So the price of autos went up every year. Today, the biggest industry out there is technology, by far. Technology inherently is disinflationary. And I think when Jay Powell is looking at it from the long in the long view, he sees that deflationary pressure. And And that is really the headwind that he's fighting. Here, look, when he says inflation is transitory, I think he says that because we know how to fight inflation. You know what? We raise rates. All right. I mean, right. We've done it. We you know what? We have the textbook. All right. It was written, under Volcker.
Paul Volcker. Yep.
We know exactly how to fight inflation. What we don't know how to do is fight deflation. We don't know how to fight what happened to Japan in the 90s when we saw them, when the Bank of Japan had rates at zero, basically. All right. And we saw the Nikkei go from 39,000 down to what? 7,000, 8,000, whatever it was. That was a deflationary spiral with everything, with real estate, everything. Every aspect of that economy was in a bubble. I know. I was an officer at NICO. I think I've said that before. Right. I saw it happening. So when you see that happen and you experience it, and all of a sudden you start to get that trader's gut feeling, you know, as we're looking at it, every asset class right now do the exact same thing, from real estate on through cryptos, it gives you that warning signal, that red flag. So when will it end? I guess is the real question. When does the party and the punch bowl get taken away and the headache come on? All right.
But Jack, we've got this. We see some inflation on the horizon. He's saying we've got the inflation building. It's going to come over the summer, and don't worry about it. You are pointing out very well that technology is disinflationary, and we've seen the effects of that. We can look at the population numbers. We don't have any population growth in this country. Productivity growth is meh. And so you get through this period, it's very easy to see over the next 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, that we're back at 2% GDP growth. Mm-hmm. The question is, when we get through this period of the summer, does a flame begin such that they lose control of this particular controlled burn? I mean, basically, they're trying to talk us through a controlled burn here.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And Michael, let's think of what's going to happen later in the year.
Yeah.
And this is my fear. Later in the year, you've got a lot of people right now, and it's anecdotal. I don't know the numbers, but when I go to the local restaurant, they're having a hard time hiring back their people. Why?
Yes.
Well, because now they're making more money on unemployment, all right, especially with the supplement, with the stimulus, than coming back. They're enjoying doing nothing and getting paid for it. I hate to say it that way, but there is a large economy. There's a large portion of people that are staying home because they're making more money doing that. Now, is that right or wrong? Okay, it's one of the reasons why we've got an imbalance here. Once those payments end, and you also have an eviction moratorium, you've got certain other things that are going
still
to
still a lot end. Of mortgages and forbearance right
you've
now.
Got a lot of people not paying a dime out there. All right. And all of that's going to come home to roost eventually. And the question is, how will that landing be? Can they actually navigate a soft landing out of this? That was one of the reasons. And I'll go back to my original statement, why I wish that they would start to tap on the brakes a little bit to let us know, with the economy starting to rip here out of this. And we're starting to see that because we might need those bullets down the road. We might need that ammunition. The Fed might need, all right, to be able to fire that exact gun that fired just a little while ago in another 2 or 3 years. And if
Jack, you're making actually a pretty good argument that the Fed doesn't have to tap the brakes, that there are brakes that are actually built in structurally to the next 6 months as the stimulus and the checks stop and people have to go out and find jobs and may go through a period where they lose purchasing power when they can't find their jobs, that eviction notices will start again, and that forbearance on various loans, at some point somebody takes a loss. A loan can't stay in forbearance forever.
Right.
Right. So it's either the borrower or the lender, and basically banks aren't showing that they're going to have any big sort of losses. They're releasing reserves right now, so they're not forecasting these problems with forbearance coming up. Maybe, you know, these sorts of structural issues will be enough of a counterbalance. Are you suggesting that? I kind of like the idea. It sounds Goldilocks, but I like it. Do you think it's enough?
I think there's another part of this equation. Remember, when we're talking about real estate, there have been some serious shifts in this during this pandemic that are permanent. All right. Yes.
They seem to be.
Oh, without question. I think being able to work remotely from anywhere, I'm able to run three companies out of my little, guest room here, which I find to be absolutely fascinating.
In Jack Barugian's bedroom, by the way. I've got him on video. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, you don't. And the dog's on the bed looking very excited. Actually, I think you ought to go take the dog's pulse. That dog looks... couldn't be more comfortable in the world. That dog is dead to the world back there.
That dog's my sweetheart. It sleeps with me. It goes, and my wife, it goes everywhere with us. It's an amazing dog. We saved it about 8 years ago.
What's her name?
It's a Mimi.
Mimi.
Yep.
Mimi looks like Mimi weighs about 35 pounds. And is white, shaggy, and looks really adorable back there.
So. 35, she's about 12, all right, to give you an idea. That's a lot of hair.
Okay, so that's a lot of fluff.
Yeah, it's a Catan. It's a nice little dog. It's a cute dog.
Very comfortable with that, Jack, talking up here. Okay, so you could, and Jack, I can't tell you what a relief it is not to be getting on as many airplanes as I used to get on.
Absolutely. You got travel has changed. Think of commercial real estate. We have an office on the 94th floor of the Willis Tower here in Chicago. I haven't seen it in a year. And quite frankly, I don't need it. And so that's a good example of something. Now, I hear of people getting forced back into the workplace, back downtown. I find that we're more, there's more productivity that takes place away from the office without an hour commute each way, without having the hassle of parking, without having all the rest of the thing. And I'll give you a prime example. One of my startups, I've got people I'm doing business with in New Zealand. I have probably talked to them more through Skype and through Zoom than ever before. And we're probably getting more done, even though they're a day and a half ahead of us.
My problem is I need, we're losing the cultural benefits at our office of folks who would wander in, who would visit the happen-bys and the new employees. I've got a new employee who is, Coleman Andrews is 23 years old, went to the University of the South in Sewanee, Tennessee. He's a very, very bright young man. He's starting, and we're having him come into the, I've got six people in the office and some folks kind of come in, but trying to get him the sense of what our culture and values are without people to go out to lunch with and hang out with. It's really hard to do that.
It's an evolution that's taking place. And that's why I talk about the shift being permanent. Here, look, it used to be where for me to bring a trader onto the floor of the exchange and teach them how to trade, that's the way you did it. You got them to feel the heat of putting the position on. All right. You can't do that anymore. There is no floor. All right. Now you've got to do it in a one-dimensional space with a screen in front of you. So we've had to actually change and morph the way we would teach proprietary traders in our industry. And that kind of logic, I think. So what I would say to somebody like you, all right, or me, is we have to start looking at the world through the eyes of our sons and daughters, all right? That age group, the millennials, the 30-somethings, the 20-somethings, they're the ones that are going to be the decision makers here. They're the ones that are taking a look at what we're doing and accepting it and embracing it because they grew up with technology. We are immigrants to technology.
Yeah.
And it becomes very easy for them to learn off of technology, whereas for us, we find it kind of impersonal.
Jack, I can't believe we're out of time. God, I love talking to you. Tell Fred and Ethel what you see for the markets between now and December 31st. And we're going to have Jack back before then, ladies and gentlemen. But between now and December 31st, and even give me your view on 2022. What happens in the economy and what happens in markets?
Right now, it's clear. You've got the Fed giving us steroid injections. What you worry about is what happens the second half of this year. Pay attention to what happens, especially with eviction moratoriums ending and unemployment stimulus. I'd be very concerned about 2022 because I think that we might be pulling a lot of those earnings up. And so that's why the second half of this year is really when I'd start to be a little concerned. Up until then, though, you got the Fed blowing as much wind into our sails as humanly possible. We've got Congress spending as much money as they can print up. All right. And you know what? There's nothing else to do but everything in sight.
And so this is not a sell in May and go away year for us, is it?
It's a hedge in May and go away. I always hedge in May and go away because I think it's better to do that. Because if you get out, it's hard to get back in.
I've never been a fan of getting out. And look, listen to Jack Barugian, folks. He's been awfully right for a long time. So you're seeing clear sailing, I'm hearing, until the fall, Jack.
That's what I'd be worried about. Yes, when the fall comes and we start to see some of the after effects of, and by then it'll be after, you know, what happens in Jackson Hole. Think about it, Michael. We might end up with a policy statement then. Usually that's when we end up with a shift, or at least, you know, the rumors of a shift. So it's going to come after that. And historically, those are tough times for the markets anyway. And, you know, I got to tell you, we've gone up quite a bit. And what I tell my friends that are up 40, 50% on positions is, you know, you have bulls, you have bears, and you have hogs, and hogs get slaughtered.
Our friend Jack Barugian, our in-house Yoda and chief economist, co-founder of UCX, one of the brightest, and ladies and gentlemen, if you can't tell it, one of the nicest guys you're ever going to talk to on Wall Street. Jack, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Michael. Have a great day.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for another Farcast. We will be back next week to try and give you our best insights from our best experts covering Wall Street, Washington, and the world. From Naples, Florida, I'm Michael Farr. Thanks so much for being with us, and please share us on your social media. We'll be back next week. Bye.
Thank you for joining us on this week's edition of the Farcast, and thanks to Michael's guest, Kenny Polcari, Dan Mahaffey, and special guest, Jack Barugian. We love hearing from you, and we try to respond to all of your notes and suggestions every week. You can reach us at hjennings@farmiller.com. Let us know any questions you have and topics you'd like to hear us cover. The Farcast comes to you weekly and is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and is available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and all major podcast platforms. We would like to remind you that the Farcast podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal or financial advice. The information, statements, comments, views, and opinions expressed and provided in this podcast, including by speakers who are not officers, employees, or agents of Farr, Miller & Washington, are not necessarily those of Farr, Miller & Washington or any firm any of our guests may represent. Any mention of a specific security should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell, and please be aware that past performance is not a guide to the future performance of any index, fund, manager, security, or strategy. We strongly recommend you review with a financial professional before you make any investment decision. And if we can be of assistance at Farr, Miller & Washington, please reach out to me at hjennings@farrmiller.com. We are here to help, and I'll be happy to put any of our listeners in touch with one of our investment professionals for a complimentary review of your portfolio and your investment goals. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy. We'll be back with you next week with more insights into the economic and investing landscape. Go beyond the headlines each week with the Farcast. Wall Street, Washington, and the world.